Pentagon did, believing that the Army and Navy were taking service bias to wild, almost treacherous extremes. Two of the top Soviet experts at RAND were Arnold Horlick, later head of Soviet estimates at the CIA, and Myron Rush. Rush's claim to fame was that he had, almost alone, predicted the rise of Khrushchev to top power from studying the sequence of photographs of Kremlin officials gathered together for parades in Red Square or other formal occasions. It was an esoteric form of intelligence that gave rise to the term Kremlinologist. In 1959, they had co-authored a top-secret memorandum, uncommon, as I've said, at RAND, that warned with unusual urgency that the Soviets were probably conducting a crash program on ICBMs that would give them a significant first-strike capability as early as 1959. That is, right then. Their main basis for this was a close analysis of all Khrushchev's statements on the subject. Their premise was that Bolsheviks did not bluff. On that assumption, the sequence of his allusions to rockets and sausage-making told them he had already arrived at the capability he had earlier predicted and now claimed. They were wrong. Khrushchev had been bluffing. That was what the new estimate was saying. It was correct, as Horlick and Rush themselves acknowledged not much later, in a top-secret report that was subsequently published. But many at RAND had believed their earlier memorandum, and my briefing was not enough to change that inclination. More important, the estimate contradicted and essentially invalidated the key RAND studies on SAC vulnerability since 1956. Those studies had explicitly assumed a range of uncertainty about the size of the Soviet ICBM force that might play a crucial role in combination with bomber attacks. Ever since the term missile gap had come into widespread use after 1957, Albert Wolstetter had deprecated that description of his key findings. He emphasized that those were premised on the possibility of clever Soviet bomber and sub-launched attacks, in combination with missiles or, earlier, even without them. He preferred the term deterrent gap. But there was no deterrent gap either. Never had been. Never would be. To recognize that was to face the conclusion that RAND had, in all good faith, been working obsessively and with a sense of frantic urgency on a wrong set of problems, an irrelevant pursuit in respect to national security. That is not a recognition that most humans in an institution are quick to accept. It was to take months, if not years, for RAND to accept it, if it ever did in those terms. To some degree, it's my impression that it never recovered its former prestige or a sense of mission, though both its building and its budget eventually became much larger. For some time, most of my former colleagues continued their focus on the vulnerability of SAC, much the same as before, while questioning the reliability of the new estimate and its relevance to the years ahead. Likewise, the Air Force, and especially SAC, was reluctant and slow to accept the new figures, despite the fact that they seemed to support what SAC and the JCS thought was a desirably tough U.S. position on the Berlin crisis. Both RAND and the Air Force expected the Soviets to build up their missile force. But that build-up, which did begin in 1963 and 1964, particularly after Khrushchev was replaced by Brezhnev, could never promise the Soviets the strategic advantages it might have offered in 1958 to 1962. Meanwhile, the Berlin crisis itself still appeared very serious. The president's attempt to mobilize public opinion for a confrontation, precisely by raising the serious possibility of nuclear war, had backfired. His decision to encourage a major private fallout shelter program was a misjudgment, mobilizing instead great controversy. The Russians continued to affirm their determination to sign a peace treaty and turn over access control of Berlin to the East Germans. Flying back to Washington in late September following my abortive attempt to reorient thinking at RAND, and with the Berlin game and Abe Chase's conclusion still fresh in my mind, I had one immediate concern. How could this new estimate be used to change our prospects in Berlin? West Berlin remained deep within Soviet-controlled territory. The erection of the Berlin Wall had commenced, with Kennedy's acceptance, even relief. From Khrushchev's point of view, that was a solution to his immediate problem. the exodus of emigrants from East Germany through Berlin. It even turned out to be an adequate solution to his longer-term problem of stabilizing the regime in East Germany, and thus strengthening the Soviets' position in Eastern Europe. But that wasn't immediately seen or accepted by Khrushchev, and still less by the West. Khrushchev's ultimatum about giving control of access to the East Germans by the end of the year was still standing, as were his warnings against our trying to maintain our access by any military means. Now, suddenly, both these threats appeared to have been based on an immense, years-long bluff about his strategic parity with the United States. Recently discovered documents from the Soviet archives show that he was at this time bluffing his own Warsaw Pact allies, as well as ours in NATO, about this parity, to reassure them about his management of the crisis and the risks of his apparently provocative diplomacy. So why not let him know privately that his bluff had been discovered, and that he should withdraw his ultimatum and his threats? I set out to draft proposals along those lines. Chapter 11. A Tale of Two Speeches. For years, the specter of a missile gap had been haunting my colleagues at RAND and in the Defense Department. The revelation that this had been illusory cast a new perspective on everything. It might have occasioned a complete reassessment of our own plans for a massive buildup of strategic weapons, thus averting an otherwise inevitable and disastrous arms race. It did not. No one known to me considered that for a moment. But in the short run, it offered other opportunities, particularly regarding the problem of Berlin. My first thought was for President Kennedy to convey this new understanding of the situation directly to Premier Khrushchev. He could do this through private secret channels to minimize Khrushchev's humiliation and reluctance to back down. I wrote two memos, basically for Kennedy's eyes. To get them to Kennedy, I gave them to Carl Kaysen, who was working for McGeorge Bundy on nuclear issues, and whom I'd dealt with on the delegation problem earlier in the spring. One of the memos I gave him, dated October 9th, was a recommended set of talking points for Kennedy to address to Khrushchev, or some representative of his. The other memo, a proposal for educating Khrushchev, was to explain the first to the president, to make the purpose of the message to Khrushchev explicit. The idea was to make it clear to Khrushchev that we knew exactly what he had, and I proposed to tell him not only the number, 4 ICBMs, but also the precise coordinates of the base at Plesetsk. For completeness, we could include the coordinates of the Turatom test site, where they had a couple of test missiles. The implied message was, you can drop all this bullshit you've been putting out about parity and superiority. We know what you've got and where it is. You've got hardly anything, and what little you have is vulnerable. So stop talking about giving us trouble on Berlin. You know and we know you are in no position to do that. Those were not the words, but that was the meaning I wanted to convey. Kaysen read these and offered to discuss them with me. He was driving from the White House over to a meeting elsewhere in Washington, and asked me to come with him in the car. He said, "Look, Dan, you've got to take into account the nature of the channel here, using information theory terms about the president, his boss. Kennedy will simply never, he will not talk like this." It wasn't clear to me whether he was saying this critically about Kennedy, or whether he agreed with the president's style. He just repeated, "It's unthinkable. Kennedy would not talk this way to Khrushchev." It still seemed important to me, though, to get it through to the Soviets somehow that they should not commit themselves on this issue, as if they thought we believed their claims of strategic superiority or even equality. We know these claims are not true, so don't dig yourself in on threats you are not going to be ready to carry out. That was the minimum message I wanted Khrushchev to hear. Commitments to threats like these carry real risks, and things can get out of hand. But I got it from Kaysen that Kennedy wouldn't say that directly to Khrushchev, either face-to-face with his representative or in a private message. A day or two after that, I was back at the Pentagon in the office of Adam Yarmolinsky, the assistant to the Secretary of Defense. I was still a RAND consultant, paid by RAND on an open-ended Air Force contract, but I was spending more than half the year in Washington working on papers and staff work in the Pentagon and State Department. Adam told me that he was working on a draft speech for Kennedy to give at a war college. Several agencies had been asked to send proposed drafts to the White House, and he was drafting one for McNamara to send. He asked me to look at it and add anything I thought should be included. So here was another chance to get the president to send my message, this way publicly. I put in many of the same themes I had included in my memos, adjusting the tone to a public speech, not addressed personally to Khrushchev. I wrote them out longhand on notepad paper and gave them to Adam, who exclaimed, "This is good." He put them all into his draft for McNamara. A little later, he told me, "McNamara likes it. He sent it to the White House." Days later, I read the speech Kennedy made, which confirmed what Kaysen had said to me about Kennedy's more conciliatory style. He hadn't used anything I said, so I gave up on Kennedy as the channel for my message. But then I dropped in on my friend Timothy Stanley, Paul Nitz's special assistant in ISA, where I hung out most of the time in Washington, for whom I had worked on the war plans earlier in the year, and who had checked out my memo on the LST at Iwakuni. Stanley had a little cubbyhole office across from the entry to the Assistant Secretary of Defense's office. 3 years later, I would inhabit this same office when I became special assistant to Nitz's successor, John McNaughton. Stanley said that he was drafting a speech for Roswell Gilpatrick. I gave Tim my original handwritten notes and said, "Look, I wrote this for Kennedy and he didn't use it. You can use it if you want for your speech." He read what I had written. It wasn't a whole speech, just several pages of key points, including this statement: "Our forces are so deployed and protected that a sneak attack could not effectively disarm us." Right after reading that, Tim looked up and read the next paragraph aloud. "The destructive power which the United States could bring to bear even after a Soviet surprise attack upon our forces would be as great as, perhaps greater than, the total undamaged force which the enemy can threaten to launch against the United States in a first strike. In short, we have a second strike capability which is at least as extensive as what the Soviets can deliver by striking first. Therefore, we are confident that the Soviets will not provoke a major nuclear conflict." He asked with surprise, "Is that true?" I said, "Trust me, Tim, it's true. That's the way it is." This particular calculation was pretty simple on the basis of what I'd learned about the Soviet arsenal. 4 ICBMs, 150-odd strategic bombers. Although the new NIE had not made any comparison of U.S. and Soviet forces before or after an attack by either, it was easy for me to be confident of my net assessment of a nuclear exchange, in Pentagon language, startling as it was to anyone who had spent years hearing about the missile gap or reading RAND classified reports on SAC vulnerability. I was sure it would stand up in the course of bureaucratic reviews of this speech. The question was, would Gilpatrick be allowed to say it, to make such a revelation, given that the administration had not chosen so far to do so? Tim had been given no assignment to make such a revelation, and his draft, when I first saw it, was the standard Pentagon boilerplate that every official in the Defense Department put in almost every speech, about our military buildup, and how much we had added to the reserves and our offensive forces, plus some talk about Berlin. In adding, as he did, nearly all my points, he totally changed the tone and bearing of his draft. Some of my language didn't get in, but this did. "Our confidence in our ability to deter communist action or resist communist blackmail is based upon a sober appreciation of the relative military power of the two sides. We doubt that the Soviet leadership has, in fact, any less realistic views, although this may not always be apparent from their extravagant claims. While the Soviets use rigid security as a military weapon, their Iron Curtain is not so impenetrable as to force us to accept at face value the Kremlin's boasts. The fact is, this nation has a nuclear retaliatory force of such lethal power that an enemy move which brought it into play would be an act of self-destruction on his part." That was the key point. My intended message was, for informed ears in the Kremlin and NATO, "We've discovered they are bluffing." And for the American and European public, "We're staying in Berlin, and there's going to be no war." I thought of it as calling Khrushchev's bluff. I even rammed it home. The Soviets' bluster and threats of rocket attacks against the free world, aimed particularly at the European members of the NATO alliance, must be evaluated against the hard facts of United States' nuclear superiority, which I discussed earlier. And with my new confidence that U.S. patrols along the Berlin corridors would not be obstructed, I felt free to underline our commitment in the final paragraph. The United States does not seek to resolve disputes by violence, but if forceful interference with our rights and obligations should lead to violent conflict, as it well might, though I no longer believe this, the United States does not intend to be defeated. Gilpatrick gave this speech on October 21, 1961, including these passages and others written by me, which were then quoted by the New York Times report of the speech. In fact, all the passages quoted there and in virtually every other journalistic or scholarly account since then were among those above, proposed and written by me. In line with the subtitle of this book, a confession is in order here. For decades after my work in the 60s on nuclear planning, I would have said that I had never proposed or been party to a threat of a nuclear first strike or first use in a crisis. I'm confident I could have passed a lie detector test on that assertion. Yet that would have been false. What else was I saying in my draft passages for the Gilpatrick speech, but that if the Soviets blocked our enlarged patrols along the Berlin corridors with some of their armored divisions in the neighborhood, they would have been taking an unacceptable risk of U.S. first use of nuclear weapons against those forces. Moreover, I was implying that we could do so in confidence that the Soviets would not respond with their own plentiful short-range nuclear weapons, because we would then exploit our nuclear superiority in strategic weapons to disarm and destroy the Soviet Union itself. How could I have failed to notice or recall over the years these implications of my own speech drafting in the fall of 1961? Well, I have to conclude, the same way most humans manage not to recognize or remember discordant or unpleasant aspects or consequences of their own behavior. Like everyone I worked with the possible exception of Abe Chase, I wanted to hold on to West Berlin. At the same time, like my closest colleagues, I would have been appalled to achieve this goal by initiating nuclear war on any scale. Yet, without making a deal with Khrushchev to recognize East Germany, something not within my ken, there was never any way to safeguard Berlin from Soviet conventional and nuclear-armed forces in East Germany, except to threaten nuclear weapons and express a readiness to escalate to a nuclear first strike. So as far as I was concerned, that ought to have been a total bluff. But in the giddy euphoria of the new intelligence, it seemed to me a bluff that was sure to work. That made it easy for me not to notice or to forget that it was, after all, a first-use and first-strike nuclear threat. That did not go unnoticed in the Soviet Union. The day after Gilpatrick's speech, Minister of Defense Rodion Malinovsky told the 22nd Congress of the Communist Party in Moscow that Gilpatrick had addressed a meeting of the Business Council in Virginia, presumably not without President Kennedy's knowledge, and brandishing the might of the United States, threatened us with force. What is there to say to this latest threat, to this petty speech? Only one thing. The threat does not frighten us. They are threatening to reply with force to our just proposals for a Germany peace treaty and the ending of the abnormal situation in West Berlin. A realistic assessment of the picture would lead one to believe that what the imperialists are planning is a surprise nuclear attack on the USSR and the socialist countries. I was gratified to see the Soviet defense minister responding so promptly and directly to my words, and so defensively as it seemed to me. His claimed interpretation of what I had written went right past me as Soviet hyperbole. After all, I knew, and I supposed he knew, that we had no intention or plans for a surprise nuclear attack. The speech said nothing explicitly about U.S. first strike capabilities or conceivable intentions. And I, the drafter of the offending comments, had no desire to see nuclear war under any circumstances at all. What was the threat Malinovsky was complaining about? In his words, it was merely a threat of force, not nuclear attack of any kind. More precisely, it was a warning that we would force our way, with conventionally armed patrols, past an attempt by East Germans to block our access to West Berlin. As I thought of it then and later, we were simply puncturing their baseless claims of nuclear superiority, and their threats of cutting us off from Berlin on the basis of their genuine conventional superiority in the area. Still, as I've just acknowledged, there was more to what he was claiming about what I'd written than I admitted to myself. What of the relation of President Kennedy himself to these threats? Most accounts of the origins of the speech attribute the substance of the passages I wrote to presidential initiative. As the historian Michael Beschloss puts it, "The President, Bundy, Rusk, and McNamara collaborated with Gilpatrick on a text for his business council speech. Drafting of the speech was assigned to Daniel Ellsberg." Not so. All those officials undoubtedly signed off on the finished speech before it was delivered. And some or all may have earlier encouraged a strong statement about our military buildup and relative superiority, which Tim Stanley was drafting when I approached him. Probably none of them, starting with Gilpatrick, knew of my role at all. None communicated with me before or after. I had no assignment. I've described above the actual sequence of events. Beschloss goes on to correctly recount my earlier exchange with Kaysen, including my suggestion that we give Khrushchev the exact coordinates of his four ICBMs, but he puts it incorrectly after I had supposedly been given this assignment to draft the speech, something that never happened. As in the New York Times account, every one of the five passages from the speech that Beschloss quotes on the balance were by me, taken from my handwritten notes originally drafted for JFK and given to Stanley at my initiative. I note this not from pride of authorship. As I've mentioned above, it makes me uncomfortable to realize that I've misinterpreted for more than half a century what I was really promoting in this instance. I've long thought, as I did at the time, that I was simply warning that we would act confidently with conventional force to assert our rights and obligations with respect to access to Berlin. We would not be deterred from that, I was saying, by the Soviet nuclear bluffs I was implicitly exposing. But they had never been threatening nuclear first use over Berlin or anywhere else. We were. It didn't stand out in my mind that Khrushchev's bluffs had been precisely to counter our nuclear first use threats, on which we were relying in the face of their real conventional superiority in Germany. I was participating in those nuclear threats without acknowledging it to myself. All right, I'd joined the crowd. But in retrospect, it was much worse than that. From the perspective of 1 year later, my initiative and my provocative words were near disastrous. That wasn't clear right away, quite the contrary. The threats appeared at the time to have worked with spectacular speed. When I first learned soon after that Khrushchev's ultimatum on signing a peace treaty with East Germany, giving control of access to the East Germans, had been withdrawn during the party conference, I and some others in the Pentagon assumed that the Gilpatrick speech had led to this decision. That was very gratifying to me to think. I felt for a long time afterward that I had contributed to ending the Berlin crisis in 1961. I was disconcerted almost 40 years later when an account written by my friend Seymour Hersh brought to my attention that Khrushchev had publicly withdrawn his ultimatum that America negotiate a post-war peace treaty with Germany by the end of 1961. 4 days earlier than the Gilpatrick speech, in his opening speech to the Party Congress. Thus, the Gilpatrick speech seemed to be Kennedy's response to the Soviet retreat. Michael Beschloss had pointed out even earlier, by asking Gilpatrick to make this speech, Kennedy may have strengthened his own domestic political standing and reassured American allies, but he also provocatively undermined Khrushchev's position in the Kremlin and in the world. The chairman's entire domestic and foreign strategy was based on creating the illusion of Soviet nuclear might. Now, as the world learned that the emperor had no clothes, Khrushchev must have imagined that the Third World and perhaps even Soviet allies, previously mesmerized by Soviet power, might begin turning away from Moscow. Khrushchev had fashioned an illusion of Soviet strength most of all so that the United States would treat his country as an equal. Now Kennedy seemed to have deliberately chosen to humiliate him. Khrushchev's first reaction was to go ahead with a 30-megaton nuclear test explosion 2 days after the speech, soon followed by a 58-megaton explosion, the largest ever. The 30-megaton blast and Malinovsky's tough language may have temporarily consoled the party Congress delegates, but the deeply serious problems created for Khrushchev by Gilpatrick's speech remained. It pressured him to do something spectacular to change the world's perception of the nuclear balance between the Soviet Union and the United States. Beschloss concludes, "The speech violated the president's own rule against backing an enemy into a dangerous corner. Kennedy never gave sufficient thought to how Khrushchev might receive the speech. Whether or not that was true for all the high officials who approved the address, I have to say that shoe fits me." Khrushchev almost certainly wondered why the president had decided to publicly humiliate him by rubbing his nose in the fact of Soviet inferiority, and amid a crucial party Congress. Did the address foreshadow an American first strike against the Soviet Union? Khrushchev knew that his Kremlin and military critics would now demand that he relax his opposition to a huge Soviet military buildup. The forces set in motion by the Gilpatrick speech and Kennedy's other efforts to demonstrate superiority compelled Khrushchev to look for a quick, cheap way to remake the nuclear balance of power. As Khrushchev might have put it, by authorizing the Gilpatrick speech, the President of the United States was playing with fire. Within a few months, Khrushchev had thought of a cheap, quick way to repay the humiliation and restore the balance. That wasn't the only or even the main aim or the triggering cause of his deployment of nuclear weapons to Cuba in 1962. Nevertheless, in October 1961, I had done my part in greasing the skids toward the Cuban Missile Crisis. When I visited Adam Yarmolinsky in his office next to McNamara's in early June 1962, after spending the first half of the year writing my Ph.D. thesis at RAND, he mentioned that he had been assigned to draft a commencement speech for McNamara to deliver in July at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, his alma mater. McNamara had decided for this occasion that he wanted to give an unclassified version of a speech he had presented at the NATO conference in Athens on May 5th. That had been drafted, Adam told me, by Bill Kaufman. Adam had rewritten Bill's speech considerably. He handed me his draft and asked me to read it for comments. I asked for and got the source document as well, the Athens speech, which was classified Cosmic Top Secret, NATO's top secret. McNamara had laid out, for the first time for the ears of our NATO allies, the No Cities counterforce coercive strategy first promoted at RAND and by Kaufman himself, underlying my draft guidance that McNamara adopted the year before. The United States had concluded, he said, that in a nuclear war stemming from a major attack on the alliance, our principal military objectives should be the destruction of the enemy's military forces, not its civilian population, while retaining reserve forces capable of threatening its urban industrial targets. This would give the Soviets very strong incentives to adopt similar strategies, to avoid urban targets of the alliance, providing the best hope of preserving the fabric of societies in the course of the war. When I compared Yarmolinsky's draft for Ann Arbor with the Athens speech, I had a number of negative reactions. The least of these was that I thought the logic of the approach was spelled out more clearly in Kaufman's original speech than in the new version. Adam's draft not only left out, necessarily, the classified figures for NATO and Soviet military forces and capabilities, but in an effort to reach a lay audience, it seemed to me to blur the rationale for the new approach, which was, after all, a striking departure from U.S. strategic planning heretofore. Second, I questioned the diplomacy of the speech in alliance terms. That applied to the Athens version as well. Kaufman, with little guidance given to him initially for a classified speech to NATO on the new strategy, had chosen to present it implicitly as an attack on the French independent nuclear force, which Charles de Gaulle was in the process of constructing. The speech emphasized the importance of centralized control to a strategy aimed at avoiding destruction of civilians in urban areas on both sides, leaving them unhit in initial attacks but threatened by U.S. forces held in reserve. Without naming the French force explicitly, which de Gaulle had no intention of coordinating with U.S. forces and which was known to be aimed solely at a few Soviet cities, principally Moscow, Kaufman drew attention to the contradiction that such a force posed for the very possibility of the U.S. strategy, which purported to have the best or only chance of preserving the fabric of Allied societies in nuclear war. For an uncoordinated French attack to destroy Moscow and some other cities at the outset of the war would mean the destruction of our hostages, the Soviet cities, assuring catastrophic Soviet attacks in kind on cities of the Alliance. Kaufman had added to this point a characterization of the projected Allied forces that seemed almost meant to offend the French, if not the British as well. In short, then, limited nuclear capabilities operating independently are dangerous, expensive, prone to obsolescence, and lacking in credibility as a deterrent. I didn't see the point of gratuitously insulting the two Allies even in a classified speech among their colleagues, let alone in a public address. But both the critique of the role of the independent forces and the aggressive language persisted in Yarmolinsky's version. When I questioned this, Adam told me that this followed McNamara's explicit guidance for his draft for Ann Arbor. McNamara had liked both Kaufman's general frame and his specific language. He had delighted in sticking it to the French in Athens, and though he knew the French were unhappy about this, he wanted to do it again at Ann Arbor. I never learned his motives for this. Like Kaufman, he must have felt angry at de Gaulle. I felt strongly that this subject was totally unsuitable for public discussion. Even our Allied military commanders had never heard in any detail whatsoever how the United States actually proposed to fight a nuclear war. After all, General Curtis LeMay had spent more than a decade keeping all such matters as secret as he could, even from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as well as from all civilian officials. I told Adam that I expected the American public, hearing of this for literally the first time, would be appalled. My reaction may need a little explaining. Yes, I had been proud of the effort I had made the previous year in helping shape this very strategy that was being expounded. Earlier this same week I had reviewed for Gilpatrick the new JSCAP 63, submitted for his approval for the first time by the JCS, and found that it had incorporated, in language at least, virtually all the changes I had proposed over his signature in 1961. But that had been because I was rejecting and replacing an Eisenhower-era plan that seemed to me to be unequivocally much worse. Moreover, in the spring of 1961, I had been working on guidance for what the JSCAP explicitly said was for use in the event of a Soviet non-nuclear assault in Europe. I assumed, however, that it was actually for use as a retaliatory second strike plan, since I still believed that the Soviets had either a predominant strategic missile force or a parity in second strike capability, either of which practically ruled out U.S. escalation to a first strike, regardless of our alliance commitment. So, for a desperate situation, my plan was, in my own understanding, the least awful way to respond to a Soviet surprise attack. In this context, its prospects didn't have to look good or even tolerable, and they certainly didn't to me. They looked very probably catastrophic. To be acceptable for operational planning, as I was proposing, they had only to look less terrible than any available alternatives, including the previously existing plan. The strategy seemed to offer the possibility of avoiding catastrophes that would be even worse and more certain. This was not a reassuring message to present to the public. Understandably, no attempt had ever been made to present it to them officially. But in 1962, it was going to have an even worse ring to it. In the context of a classified NATO audience at Athens, and in light of the great imbalance of forces we had learned about in September 1961, McNamara was now describing this planning as a U.S. first strike strategy, in fulfillment of our long-term commitment to NATO in response to a Soviet attack on Western Europe. A high-level NATO audience was used to hearing, you might say they demanded, reiterations of our intent to attack the Soviet Union in that case, though they'd never heard in such detail just how we planned to do it. But it had never been forced on the attention of the American public that a large Soviet non-nuclear attack on Europe, not on the continental United States, would almost automatically trigger a full-scale U.S. nuclear attack on the Soviet Union, with the certainty of Soviet retaliation on the United States to the full limits of its capability. Moreover, The U.S. public had never been given any real hint as to how limited that Soviet capability was in 1961 and 1962, with respect to the U.S. homeland. Although the Kennedy administration had acknowledged in late 1961 that there was no missile gap, and the Gilpatrick speech, with my input, had even implied that we were significantly superior to the Soviets in strategic nuclear power, the public had never been told, either officially or unofficially, just how small the Soviet ICBM force was in those years. In fact, the real terms of that disparity have never entered public consciousness to this day. A scholar as authoritative as Richard Rhodes was still writing in 1995 that the Soviets had over 40 ICBMs in 1961, 10 times more than they actually had. In Athens, McNamara had the intent of reassuring our military allies, on a highly classified basis, that we had a way of responding to a Soviet invasion of their countries that gave us enough assurance of surviving the war that we would indeed be willing, as we always said, to carry out our commitment of a nuclear first strike in that case. Moreover, the alliance should rely on the United States' way of doing this, rather than encouraging the growth of independent, French forces that would only screw up the strategy and make it infeasible by hitting Soviet cities and central command and control at the outset. However unlikely to work, the plan probably seemed to our allies. McNamara's assured tone in describing it, and the fact that the United States was investing billions to implement it, may also have convinced some of them that McNamara actually believed in it and would carry it out in the event, or at least that would be the Soviet impression. And that might well scare the Soviets enough to keep them from encroaching on Western Europe. McNamara and Kaufman, I thought, were surely mistaken if they thought its logic was so compelling as to dissuade the French from pursuing their force de fop, which it certainly didn't do. But all these potential benefits, however speculative, didn't offer themselves at all to unveiling this strategy to the American public, especially in a first strike context. The language of the Athens speech and Yarmolinsky's draft version seemed strongly to suggest that the American government put confidence in the results of a coercive strategy in a nuclear war, avoiding Soviet cities while threatening them with reserve forces as we attacked Soviet military forces. Any such confidence was bound to look bizarre, absurd. I learned later that Bill Kaufman had had exactly the same reactions as I did to the idea of presenting the substance of his classified Athens speech to the American public and the world in a public address. Yarmolinsky had asked him to do the job of declassifying his speech for this event, and he refused. He didn't believe that should be done, for all the reasons I felt. So Yarmolinsky did the job on his own. After reading Yarmolinsky's draft, I handed it back to him and told him as firmly as I could that I thought the speech must not be given. McNamara would have to find another subject for his commencement address. As I was saying this in Adams' office, he got a call on the direct line from the Secretary of Defense. He said, "Yes, Bob. Well, I have Dan Ellsberg standing here with me just now, and he's read my draft and doesn't like it. He feels strongly that it shouldn't be given." I could hear McNamara's voice on the other end, but couldn't make out what he was saying. I was feeling, I remember, a small glow that Adam would mention my name to McNamara as an authority, without having to remind him who I was. I'd been out of Washington for 6 months, and I'd met McNamara directly only once, half a year before that. Adam said, "Okay, Bob," and hung up. He said, "Bob says you should write it the way you think it should be." Rats. That was not a job I wanted, especially after I'd spent one all-nighter commenting on the JSCAP. But there was no question of turning it down. This was the first time I'd ever gotten a request directly from McNamara. The problem was that I didn't think anything like this speech should be given to the public, and Adam had already made clear to me that McNamara wanted something along the lines of the Athens speech, and that he specifically wanted parts including the crack at the French, that I was particularly doubtful about. Adam found me a desk in his suite of offices, and I got to work. As I again compared Kaufman's speech with Adam's much-revised draft, it again seemed to me that Bill's version was better worded, and its logic followed more clearly. I made another copy of each and started out replacing some of Adam's paragraphs with Bill's. These were the days long before personal computers, or even Selectric typewriters with automatic erasure and correction. Secretaries made corrections on good copies by using whiteout fluid and typing over it. I took a scissors and cut out the parts of Bill's draft that seemed well said, and taped them where I wanted into Adam's version, cutting that apart for insertions. I rearranged Adam's sections, and I wrote out sentences and paragraphs of transitions or exposition where I thought it was now needed. What I thought I was doing was a kind of mock-up that I thought presented the argument that McNamara wanted better than Adam had done. If McNamara bought it, then we had a month before the speech was due to be presented. There would be time to do a really decent job, if I couldn't persuade them after all that this was a bad idea altogether. I had told Yarmolinsky, not in detail, the nature of my reservations to publicizing the Athens speech. But McNamara hadn't heard them, and that's not what he had asked me for. I didn't think I had time both to write those out for him and to draft from scratch an entirely different speech that I thought would be more suitable, so I made the choice, in retrospect a bad one, of simply editing Adam's draft, partly with the aid of Bill's original. In the end, what I had was a speech that I thought read better than Adam's, but was in fact closer to Bill's original Athens speech than Adam's had been. It didn't at all cure my most fundamental objections to the tone and substance. Maybe my lack of sleep was taking its toll on my critical sense. I had taken out parts of the original that I thought were, as I would have put it later, too strange-lovian. Not nearly enough, as it turned out. Still, I did cut out McNamara's presentation of the results of studies of a hypothetical nuclear war in 1966, 4 years away, in which he contrasted two possible courses of events. Where both sides confined their attacks to military targets, the United States might suffer 25 million deaths, the Soviets the same, and Europe somewhat fewer. But if both sides attacked urban industrial targets as well, the United States might incur 75 million deaths, the Soviets at least 100 million, and Europe 115 million. He said, "While both sets of figures make grim reading, the first set is preferable to the second." His argument that the U.S. strategy, under centralized U.S. control, had the best or only chance of attaining the first set of outcomes, rather than the second set, in a future nuclear war, was what underlay his prior assertion that, in our best judgment, destroying enemy forces while preserving our own societies is a not wholly unattainable objective. This last phrase, along with two sets of figures he presented, would not seem to be greatly overselling the prospects of preserving societies by this new strategy, even though it really was essentially mistaken, as we'll see. In fact, reading these estimates, since declassified 55 years later, it is hard to imagine how this presentation could have been in any way reassuring to an audience of hardened military professionals in Athens. It was clearly not suitable for the graduating class at the University of Michigan to hear, or for any other audience that had not become inured to RAND or JCS classified studies. I also omitted his too revealing reference to Soviet cities that had not yet been hit as hostages. In the morning, I handed the cut-and-paste version with my interpolations to one of the office secretaries, who were all capable of retyping drafts at lightning speed. I gave the typed version to Adam, who said, "This is good," and sent it to McNamara. A little later that morning, I hadn't yet gone back to my hotel to sleep, Adam told me, "McNamara says it's fine, he's going to go with it." I said with real concern, "Wait a minute, that's just a rough overnight draft. We've got 4 weeks before it's given, plenty of time to improve it." Adam said, "No, he's done with it, he's satisfied. He doesn't change his mind about these things, that's the way it's going to go." I was unhappy, but shrugged it off. I went back to my hotel to go to sleep. In July, it was a disaster. The French, of course, were furious that McNamara's contemptuous dismissal of their force was aired publicly. The editorial in American Public's response, about as bad as I'd foreseen. Khrushchev's reaction I learned only half a century later, from Alexander Frisenko and Timothy Naftali's Khrushchev's Cold War. Khrushchev had decided in May to secretly send missiles to Cuba, in part in reaction to my Gilpatrick speech. According to Frisenko and Naftali, Soviet intelligence had apparently missed the Athens speech. Surprisingly, as we generally thought that NATO was penetrated enough by the Soviets that a speech to the NATO Council was a secret channel to Moscow. But when Khrushchev read about the Ann Arbor speech, what McNamara said irritated the Soviet leader because the Secretary of Defense explained that in the future, NATO should consider targeting Soviet military installations instead of cities. The U.S. government was making this argument because it wanted to discourage the French, the British, and the West Germans from building their own nuclear forces, which were inefficient and hard to control and bred Soviet concerns. Only the U.S. force was technologically sophisticated enough to hit the Soviet missile silos. But what Khrushchev heard was that McNamara was somehow trying to make nuclear war seem less bloody and therefore more acceptable. Minutes after outlining a new Berlin offensive, Khrushchev railed against McNamara at the July 1st Presidium meeting. "Not targeting cities. How aggressive? What is their aim?" he asked. Answering his own question, as he often liked to do, Khrushchev replied, "To get the population used to the idea that nuclear war will take place." 10 days later, Khrushchev attacked the Ann Arbor speech publicly as seeking to legalize nuclear warfare and thereby the deaths of millions and millions of people. He also said it was deceptive to the American people, because bases in the United States were in or near large cities. "It will be first of all the civilian population that will fall victim to the weapons of mass annihilation." Khrushchev was right. To underscore that point, just 3 months later, when SAC planes were put on high alert in an ensuing crisis, many of these nuclear-loaded planes were deployed to civilian airports near major cities, making these cities high-priority targets. The same happened in October through November 1969 under President Nixon. Meanwhile, of course, the French force de frappe did go ahead, with Moscow as its principal and immediate target, negating any possibility of a no-cities, controlled, coercive central war strategy. In reality, the same remained true of SAC operational planning as well. Nevertheless, Khrushchev was bound to hear the McNamara Ann Arbor speech, like the Gilpatrick speech before it, as a first-strike threat to him. The flip side of the first-strike assurance McNamara had been giving in secret to the NATO allies in Athens. The new speech, which I'd helped craft, must have confirmed him in his clever, reckless response to the one I'd contributed to earlier. By the time of the Ann Arbor speech in July, the Soviet medium-range ballistic missiles that were meant, among other aims, to counter American assertions of strategic superiority and warnings of possible U.S. first use or first strike over Berlin, were already on their way to the Caribbean. Chapter 12. My Cuban Missile Crisis. On Monday, October 22, 1962, along with most people in America, I watched President Kennedy on television announcing that the Soviets were installing offensive ballistic missiles in Cuba, preparing a capability to attack the United States. He said we would blockade Cuba. He called it a quarantine, starting Wednesday morning. Any launch of a single missile from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere would lead to a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. That last bit sounded wild. Full response? That meant the PSYOP, the plan for general nuclear war. I was caught by that, having written the guidance for that plan 18 months earlier. Use it essentially as a first strike against the Soviet Union in the event someone, Cubans, launched one missile against anyone? I wondered if the speechwriter had any idea what he was saying. I went to the phone. I was at home in Malibu, California, and called Harry Rowan in the Pentagon. I asked him, "Could you use some help there?" He said, "Why don't you come on over here tomorrow?" I made a reservation for early the next morning and packed a bag. When I got to his office late Tuesday afternoon, Harry read me into the picture quickly. The group of principals called the XCOM, or Executive Committee of the National Security Council, had been meeting with the president, and sometimes without him, several times a day for the past week, deciding what to do. Three or four working groups of staffers were supporting them. One, centered in the Pentagon, was coordinating plans for an air attack and invasion. probably a week away as I arrived. Harry said to me, "Write a memo on what 38 missiles could do to our strike-back ability." He gave me a map with the ranges of the medium-range ballistic missiles, MRBM, and intermediate-range ballistic missiles, IRBM, shown as circles on it. Both Washington and Omaha were within reach of the MRBMs, some of which were already operational. My first thought was that that meant the command posts in the Washington area and at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, SAC headquarters, could be hit with very short warning time, minutes, essentially no warning. That was really the most significant effect. It meant the Soviets could be confident of decapitation. But I knew what most didn't, even in the Pentagon. That wouldn't spare them from a full, quick retaliation from our massive surviving forces, thanks to delegation. This ability to conduct a land-based no-warning attack on our command centers was not an insignificant effect, but it was nothing new. They could have accomplished this with cruise missiles from submarines. Therefore, we had never counted on protecting Washington or Offutt anyway. That was why the Pentagon had designed a system of alternate command posts, including at sea and airborne, as well as underground, and why Eisenhower and Kennedy had delegated authority. As for the threat to SAC's second strike ability, Harry told me that bombers had already widely dispersed, including to more than 30 civilian airfields. So much for the plans announced at Ann Arbor 4 months earlier of giving the Soviets maximum incentive to forego targeting our cities. 38 missiles meant a big expansion, relatively, of their small strategic force. In Russia, they were starting to deploy their new silo-based ICBMs, the SS-7. Perhaps 60 sites were under construction, but only about 10, Harry told me, were operational. Along with the four SS-6s at Plesetsk, for what they were worth, that meant that the Soviet first strike missile force was at least doubling, or expanding far more than that overnight. Yet it still didn't mean that they would escape total devastation if they struck first. A single surviving SAC base would assure that, and well more than one would survive. Aside from our theater forces, they would also be hit by Polaris missiles and carrier forces at sea, and surviving Atlas and Titan missiles. 50 to 100 missiles didn't give them a disarming first-strike force. Nor did the vulnerable IRBMs, which were not delivered because of the blockade, on unhardened fixed sites do much for their ability to strike second. The mobile MRBMs, if we really couldn't find all of them, would do more for their retaliatory capability. Of course, if the Soviets were allowed to base missiles on Cuba, they could quickly deploy a larger number of these from their current arsenal. 100 or so IRBMs would make a big difference to their first-strike capability, or so we calculated then, in days when it was assumed by our military that either side could accept tens of millions of deaths, though not hundreds of millions. We have an unusual record of the Cuban Missile Crisis as a result of tapes Kennedy made of meetings of the XCOM. I wasn't surprised to read, years later when the tapes were transcribed, that McNamara had said at the second XCOM meeting 1 week earlier, much the same as I had, that these missiles didn't affect our security decisively, or even significantly. "I'll be quite frank," he told the president. "I don't think there is a military problem. This is a domestic political problem." The JCS didn't agree. They were itching to attack Cuba. But McNamara's point, and mine, was that the missiles in Cuba didn't affect us much more, despite the short warning time, which the JCS made much of, than did 40 more ICBMs in the Soviet Union, which we were expecting in the next few months anyway. A year earlier, CINCSAC had been claiming that the Soviets already had 1,000 ICBMs aimed at us. 40, 50, 100 were not in that class of threat. Walt Rostow at the State Department asked me to join a working group looking at long-range plans, 2 weeks from now and more. That designation, long-range, for a 2-week time span sounds like a joke, but that perspective is what defined this as a crisis. Harry also included me in his short-term invasion planning group. As far as I know, I was the only person to be in two of these groups, and the only outside consultant in any of them. Harry's boss, Paul Nitze, was in charge of another group planning our response if the Soviets blockaded Berlin, if and when we attacked Cuba. I was staying at the DuPont Plaza Hotel, where Rand people always stayed in those days, but we were working almost around the clock. Wednesday and Thursday nights I caught some sleep on a leather sofa in Nitz's office. In Rostow's working group on Thursday morning, more than a dozen people were sitting around a long table at the State Department, reading the daily reports from the CIA on progress of the construction of the missiles and air defenses in Cuba, reports from the Pentagon on events on the blockade line, requests for information from the XCOM, and cables from embassies around the world on reactions to the crisis. I found myself reading two cables that were almost identical, word for word, to the two simulated cables in the Berlin game I had participated in a year earlier. As in that game, students were now protesting our actions at the Free University in Berlin. And in the second report, large crowds were rioting around the American Embassy in Delhi. As Walt Rostow was passing behind my chair, I turned to him and handed him the cables. He read them quickly. I said, "This shows how realistic the Berlin game was." He handed them back and said, "Or how unrealistic this is." One of his better lines. We rarely saw, in the working groups, any cabinet-level members of the XCOM, who were meeting almost continuously at the White House or State Department. Once, on Saturday morning, Secretary of the Treasury C. Douglas Dillon dropped into the Rostow group during a break in the XCOM meetings. He didn't know me, but at one point, looking in my direction, he asked, "What is it we're offering? We've got to have something to offer him to get out." I burst out, "We're offering not to hit his goddamn missiles." He looked at me incredulously, snorted, and turned away. It was wildly impudent of me, though no rank was being observed in the working groups or, as it turned out, in the XCOM, and provocative, not really my style. I'm not proud of that memory. What's worse, I have to say that it did really reflect my expectations of how the crisis would come out, or ought to. I was thinking all week, from Wednesday on, when the Soviets didn't choose to challenge the blockade, that Khrushchev had to back down without any real concession on our part. He was looking down the barrel of U.S. invasion forces that were fully primed to go on the following Monday or Tuesday, if not earlier. We had him outgunned at every level in the Caribbean, in the air, at sea, on the ground, in conventional weapons. And none of us that I knew of imagined that to redress that conventional imbalance, Khrushchev would allow any combat use of the nuclear missiles he was deploying. That conventional superiority was reversed in Europe, in Berlin or Turkey or in NATO as a whole. But our strategic nuclear superiority was so enormous that I couldn't believe he would really challenge it there either. I suspected that Dillon hadn't really absorbed, if he knew at all, how much of a mirage the notion of Soviet superiority that we all had feared in the 50s had turned out to be. It was precisely to repair that extreme strategic nuclear imbalance, I presumed, that Khrushchev had undertaken what seemed to be this desperate measure. But he had overreached. It might indeed have been a preparation to bargain over Berlin on more equal terms, or even to make new threats, and that was worth batting back. Though I wouldn't have thought it was essential to do so. Even if we had accepted it, it wouldn't have changed significantly the risks for him of confronting us over Berlin. That was pretty much what Nitze thought, and Harry, and so did the JCS. The difference was that the JCS wanted to attack Cuba, and I didn't, nor did I think it was needed to get the missiles out. I didn't even think it was essential to remove them. But I could understand the president's determination to get them out of there, even at some risk, which I foolishly thought was quite small. The deployment obviously did confront Kennedy with a domestic political problem, after he had publicly rejected Republican claims that missiles would be coming, and then that they actually arrived, following which he had given explicit notice to the Soviets that gravest issues would arise if they contradicted their assurances to him. If he failed to act on this warning, the Republicans would charge, with good reason, that he had been both foolish and weak. At that time, I hadn't come to recognize just how decisive domestic politics were in the calculations of presidents as they addressed foreign policy. But the external politics of this situation seemed enough to explain what Kennedy was doing so far in this crisis. If he had backed down from his own warnings in the face of this provocative, though legal, Soviet move, I shared the view that our allies in Europe would have been impressed by both Khrushchev's boldness and Kennedy's timidity. They would fear that Khrushchev was not likely in the future to believe Kennedy's warnings or threats, and that he was not wrong about this. Our allies would be less willing to commit themselves to threats, with respect to Berlin, that Kennedy was likely to back down from and that Khrushchev was not. So though the blockade was an act of war, illegal in peacetime, Kennedy had chosen the word quarantine precisely not to admit an analogy to the Soviets' blockade of Berlin.